Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. You might know that the word bunk is short for bunkum, meaning nonsense or insincere talk. But did you know the word was coined out of racial unrest in relation to the Missouri Compromise of 1820, which admitted Missouri to the United States as a slave state? A North Carolina representative insisted on filibustering in favor of Missouri's slave state status in the name of bunkum, his home county. With me now is Kevin Young, and he's written a book revealing that and much more called Bunk, The Rise of Hoaxes, Humbug, Plagiarists, Phonies, Post-Facts, and Fake News. And in it looks at the history of bunk and the hoax and calls it a peculiarly American phenomenon, from the legacy of P.T. Barnum's humbug to Donald Trump's fake news, of course. Young finds that a lot of the time, racism and race are at the root of why Americans create and believe in bunk. Kevin Young, as some of you know, is a poet, director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture here in the city, and the newly appointed poetry editor of The New Yorker. His last book of nonfiction, The Gray Album on the Blackness of Blackness, won the Penn Open Book Award, and the new book is called Bunk, The Rise of Hoaxes, Humbug, Plagiarists, Phonies, Post-Facts, and Fake News. Breathe. Welcome back to WNYC, Kevin.
Great to see you again.
So let's start with this. What's a hoax? How do you define it?
A hoax is something created to fool someone. It's not just a lie. It's much more elaborate than that. Often hoaxers create whole casts of characters, you know, family members, cousins, whomever, to support the hoax. And I use it as a umbrella term, and I trace in the book its origins really in the middle of the 18th century to now.
And how is the idea of the hoax connected to race?
Well, I don't think it's an accident that our modern idea of race and the term hoax evolved around the same time. And when I started looking back on it, it was kind of a hunch, but as I started to go from P.T. Barnum to the present, I really started to see it in many, many ways, whether it's P.T. Barnum's first big show, which was exhibiting a woman named Joyce Heth, who he pretended was 161 years old and the nursemaid to George Washington, which really drew people in and was his first big success, to one of his later shows, which was a little bit more troubling even, though there were troubling aspects of Joyce Heth. We know she was enslaved and perhaps even by Barnum. A gentleman named William Johnson, who had a really long career in showbiz, but it kicked off playing a figure called What Is It? And Barnum purposely made the It capitals in order to emphasize that this person who was a black man was this being. And it was in 1860, just a few months after Origin of the Species. It was kind of a brilliant thing to sort of say, in one hand, you know, here's this missing link. What is this person? Which I think was a very 19th century preoccupation, but the solution was it's not a person, it's someone in between. And going from there into the present, we really see how race plays out.
We were just talking about the Middle East in our last section, and the Middle East is a place pretty well known for, among many other things, conspiracy theories that, you know, things that may or may not have any relation to reality take root pretty deeply in popular thinking to some degree. But you present the hoax as a particularly American phenomenon. How come?
Well, and there are American hoaxes about the Middle East. I mean, there is that happens. And what I try to do is think about the ways that American ideas of reinvention and of you can become anything, which I think are really at the core of our identity here.
Is that what P.T. Barnum was selling to some degree?
Well, he had many sayings, as you probably know. One of my favorites that I quote in the book is, every crowd has a silver lining. You know, he very much is looking for the groupthink, I think, that draws people in at these audiences. But I think he was offering almost a democratic notion that people could come and see, well, do you believe that this is really a mermaid or not? What do you think? What is it? You know, there's a lot of questions in Barnum that he's asking the audience to, or trusting them or seducing them to think they can answer.
and you tell us that Barnum makes a fascinating distinction between a swindler and a humbug. What's the difference, and why does it matter?
Well, one is a good show. I think a humbug provides you a kind of pleasure after, even if you know you've been fooled. And I tried to think about what's that mean today. You know, what's an analogy to going to see a Barnum mermaid that really was a monkey sewn into a fish tail? It's a bit like reality TV is the closest I sort of came to it, something I watch and enjoy. But we often enjoy it knowing that it's kind of made up or at least constructed and highly scripted. But at the same time, there's a kind of real, it's even in the name, real impact of reality shows. And I think that kind of mix of pleasure and trying to figure out what's real and who's next and is really analogous to Barnum's humbug.
Humbug comes up in A Christmas Carol. Humbug. Humbug comes up in The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah,
when Dorothy
sure.
reveals, the fakery. Are they related?
Well, I think Wizard of Oz is great. And if I had more space and time, I think I would have thought about it because there was something about The Wizard of Oz that seemed to reference Poe. And Edgar Allan Poe had these hoaxes that weren't quite as successful right around the same time as Barnum's very successful ones. And I trace that in the book, too, in the kind of American origins of the hoax. Because Poe was really trying to, in his balloon hoax, and he had also had a moon hoax, trying to kind of evoke something that would fool people, but they were too artificial. They often had this kind of blather that made it pretty obvious it wasn't describing news. And I think the brilliance of Barnum and the brilliance of someone, other people who made hoaxes, was that they made a kind of convincing case. They made it seem like news. And in the penny papers at the time, they exploited that to convince people, at least some of them, that it was real.
And to whatever extent Barnum's hoaxes were kind of innocent, you say by the time you get to the mid-20th century, the hoax becomes more insidious. Why is that?
Well, I think because innocence becomes a ploy. I quote James Baldwin where he says the innocence is the crime. He's thinking broader about injustice, but I think it very much applies to the hoax where there's a level of kind of innocence being paraded in front of us and often about race that really is hiding a kind of set of stereotypes or set of divisive issues, which I think the hoax makes a lot of use of. I was struck again and again researching for the book the ways the hoax makes use of those deep divisions in our culture and sets them kind of a-going but also on fire. And later, it seems so obvious.
I saw a story in the news just today that I wonder if it fits into this context for you. Apparently, somebody's putting out robocalls in Alabama in support of Roy Moore that say, "Hi, I'm Lenny Bernstein from The Washington Post, and I'll pay you a lot of money to make up a sexual assault story against Roy Moore." Wow.
Yeah, I think it was even Bernie Bernstein. I mean, they went the whole hog. And I often see that, you know, a kind of not very inventive, if you step back and look at it, and obvious. But that's its perniciousness. You know, we believe the hoax. And I was started out really trying to see, like, are hoaxes worse now? Are there more of them? And I came to think yes. But also, you know, why now? Why has this happened? And I think a lot of it has to do with this deepening of the divisions that we see sometimes every day. And even those robocalls kind of indicate some of that.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is Kevin Young, who is the New Yorker's poetry editor. He's director of the Schomburg Center, and he's the author now of Bunk, The Rise of Hoaxes, Humbug, Plagiarists, Phonies, Post-Facts, and Fake News. Who has a question or a story for Kevin Young, or a poem? 212, well, I don't know if I want to encourage that. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. I see you wrote a poem about... Oh, you didn't write it. You have this in the book, in a collection, a poem that refers to a hoax that you write about, the Susan Smith hoax.
Yeah, there's some great poems by Cornelius Eady called Brutal Imagination. great title, where he's thinking, he writes poems in the voice of the made-up person that Susan Smith created.
Remind people of that story the 90s?
Yeah, she unfortunately drowned her two children in the back of her car, but she claimed that a black man had carjacked her and ran off with her children. I remember hearing that, I think in New York, you know, on the radio somewhere, going into a shop, and was like, that's no way that was that true. But it did lead to, you know, manhunts and searches of people. And a few arrests, I think, and could have had big impact. Luckily, one of the detectives was wise about sort of this and poked holes in her story. But what Cornelius Eady has done is imagine the voice of this imagined black man. There was even a sketch of him, which is really stereotypical looking. And, you know, I think it's a powerful voice that he's created that thinks about, you know, I think one of the opening lines is, "When called, I come," you know, that there is this stereotypical figure out there that Smith was drawing on. And luckily, you know, these deep divisions didn't hold sway for very long, but it does expose that. And I think the hoax regularly does reach for that and touch on that.
So Edie's very short poem was, "I watch another man pour from a white woman's head. Fear he'll live the way I did, a brute, a flimsy ghost of an idea, both of us groomed to only go so far."
Yeah, it's a powerful poem and great book. You should get it.
I know that you had a run-in with a hoaxer in your life, which partly inspired you to write this book. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, when I was in college, I worked on Let's Go, a travel guide, and the managing editor later became a hoaxer. His name is Ravi Desai, and he did a lot of different kinds of hoaxes. I think one of the most prominent was he pledged money to universities, a couple, and created a whole sort of world around that. I think he pledged millions in support of poetry. What a noble, great thing. And they threw him a huge party, of course, and the party would cost something like 10 grand, and that was more than he actually even donated. But when I was working there, he claimed he had cancer. And that's really tough later. And I talk a little bit about what it means to sort of feel de-hoaxed, you know, to go later and have experience de-hoaxing and realize that, wow, I think I was hoaxed then. And so that's part of the book. You know, it's really about that process of how we end up hoaxed, but also how we kind of can and often do undo that. And that's can be a tough process.
We'll continue in a minute with Kevin Young. I see people are calling in with hoax stories and hoax questions. And we'll talk a little bit about The New Yorker as well and the Schomburg Center, as well as more on his new book, Bunk, The Rise of Hoaxes, Humbug, Plagiarists, Phonies, Post-Facts, and Fake News, 212-433-WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Kevin Young, Schomburg Center Director, New Yorker poetry editor, author now of Bunk, The Rise of Hoaxes, Humbug, Plagiarists, Phonies, Post-Facts, and Fake News. And John O. in the West Village, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning. This is a really fascinating segment. So Bunk, I guess, originated as a Southern term, but I'm wondering if Mr. Young could talk about the idea of hoaxes and con men being viewed more as urban creatures, as the wily city people duping the simple country folk, and if that has implications of the moral worth of dangerous city people and pure country folk who are getting deceived. I'm thinking of our president, who painted himself as a man of the country, and he was not just a New Yorker, he was a Manhattanite. So there's the ultimate con man. I'm wondering if you could speak of urban versus rural as it plays into this idea.
That's a great question. I do think in the 19th century, certainly, there was this idea and even guidebooks warning folks who were coming newly to the city to be on the lookout for con men and con women. And I trace that a little bit in the book. I do think that country folk, you know, who I count as my family and loved ones, you know, are very sophisticated. So I hesitate to make that kind of clear-cut distinction. I do think that in American history, there is this notion of you know, you get off the bus in Hollywood or in the big bad city and you get taken away. But the hoax is a bit more elaborate than that, I think. It isn't just citified ways that lead to the hoax. I do think there is this notion that the hoax sometimes sells of sophistication, though. And we could maybe think about the ways that hoaxers offer this, you know, a more refined world. But often when I start to poke at and prod at what was laying beneath the surface, there's often a real crude kind of, you know, over the topness to a hoax. Something like James Frey's fake memoir, A Million Little Pieces, is very, very, you know, dramatic and lots of blood and gore and guts. And, you know, that's not exactly city or country. It's sort of deeply American, this trauma that Frey is selling us as triumph.
There are several, including Frey's, fake memoirs that you refer to. Is that a category in and of itself?
Sad to say it is. In fact, there's a moment I say in the book that someone used a nonfiction memoir. I saw that term used. I'm like, that's a terrifying term because memoir is meant to be nonfiction. But I do think this has eroded some, and we've lost kind of a sense of, and my book asks why, of what the truth is. I think the danger for me, I started to understand, isn't just to the truth, though I think the hoax does damage that and the fake memoir especially, but also to the idea of art, the idea that art could change us and that something made up, the imagination, is enough, you know. And we've now sort of, I think it's also a kind of version of reality television that sometimes we limit the self to autobiography when the self is full and exciting and imaginative.
Does this inform your idea of the place of poetry in life and culture? You're a poet. You're, as of recently, the New Yorker's poetry editor.
Yeah, I mean, I think poetry doesn't have such distinction. There isn't nonfiction poetry and fiction poetry. There's poetry. This is because there's really only two kinds of poetry: good poetry, and as Duke Ellington said of music, the other kind, you know. And I really try to emphasize that and think about, especially in this new role, which is just starting, you know, what's great, you know, and it can be a lot of different things. So I'm enjoying picking and looking and seeing the real breadth and richness, and I would say the depth of American poetry right now.
And really looking forward to seeing how you curate there. Good luck with it.
Thank you.
Constantine in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Kevin Young. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if you could speak a bit about the is hoax as possibly being revelatory or kind of breaking boundaries. About 8 years ago, I had just finished a master's in literature in England, and I was interested in how literature could be innovative now. And I looked at our times, and I thought, well, real-time technologies and reality show culture. And so I hosted an online literary reality show where the contestants, their identities were anonymous, and they were judged purely on their writing. So I would make videos in which I would announce a literary challenge, and the 12 contestants would each start the novella, and then they'd get voted off every 10 days, and I'd announce who got voted. And it acquired quite a following, and an international one. Not a big one, but a very devoted one. And then at the end, the last person, the final post, basically I revealed that I was writing all 12, all the different styles.
I see. Trickeration.
And Constantine, what's the moral of the story?
Well, you know, for me, it was never meant to be a hoax. It was trying to create something new, and I got swept up in it myself. And so, you know, some people felt deeply betrayed, and it was really hard for me afterwards because of that, because I grew close. I mean, the real characters in the end were the commenters, because they would interact with the contestants and write comments and get in fights.
Interesting.
And it was this incredible relationship that developed.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I would love to know more about that later. But I think for me, you know, it really shows the way that audiences quickly become invested in the realness of what they're presented. And I talk a little bit about the pact that, you know, art makes or fiction makes. And I think of it very much as related to fairy tales we're told as a child. You can have them be wild and do all sorts of things that they're filled with danger and betrayal, like the grandmother can become a wolf, but the grandmother telling the story can't then turn out to be a wolf, even if that's the anxiety the fairy tale is expressing. So there's this kind of contained quality in the tale itself that lets you be kind of wild. But we do have this reaction when we find out that the storyteller isn't who the storyteller says they are. Now, of course, this is the start of the novel in some ways, and I trace that too. And I don't think it's an accident that the hoax and the novel come around the same time, but they take very different paths. And a novel that lasts has to rely on its words, and many times when hoaxes are exposed, it becomes really clear that they don't stand up without that autobiographical propping of the fake story around it.
You write in the book that post-truth and alt-right are not only euphemisms, but synonyms. Why?
Well, I think that this idea of, even alt-right is euphemism. It's something made up to cover the issues that 10 minutes before would have been called white nationalism or just straight racism. And I think it's a confusing moment when the words are getting in the way of the meaning of the thing. And that's, I think, the danger of what I call the age of euphemism. And post-facts and kind of what now gets called fake news often just means news I don't like, or it's an accusation against factual provable things, like that Obama was actually not president during Hurricane Katrina, say. But, instead you see people really invested in things that are provably untrue. And the question I wrestle with in the book is it harder now? You know, has the internet changed things? How has technology affected us? How has our need for narrative, which I think is very much part of this, being manipulated or played on and satisfied perhaps too easily by the hoax?
And here in the Trump era, in the final pages of the book, you put forth the notion that the truth might not be an absolute relative, but a skill, a muscle like memory that we've neglected so much that we've grown measurably weaker using it. Do you think we can rebuild that muscle?
We can rebuild him. You know, I do think that that's a $6 million man reference from the 70s, sorry. Yes, I think we can rebuild it. The truth, I think, is something that we can, but I do think it's going to take some effort and some honesty about how we got here, about what hoaxes are really about. And I think that so long people said they were just fact or fiction. It was just about this blurry line, when the truth is that line isn't that blurry. And I found time and time again that people really reach for these kind of stereotypical ideas, things that are kind of shorthand that let them make the hoax possible. And then once revealed, the hoax really reveals other things about what we deeply believe. And sometimes it's the worst about each other.
Forgive me for not getting the $6 million man reference.
Sorry, I've got a lot of 70s TV in there.
I'm deeply humiliated. We have about a minute left. What's going on at the Schomburg?
Well, it's an exciting moment. You know, we just went through a multi-million dollar renovation, and we're open for business, and we have gotten some really great acquisitions lately, including the James Baldwin Archive, which has just been tremendous. Also, the Sonny Rollins papers, those are being processed right now, but involve home recordings and various things of this super genius, you know. And
are you part of the movement to rename the Williamsburg Bridge for Sonny Rollins, played there?
I would throw my vote in that camp. But, you know, I think we're really excited about the idea of bringing home to Harlem these figures who, in Baldwin and Rollins' case, were born and grew up there, and looking ahead to doing that in other ways and bringing the black cultural capital of the world that is Harlem home and again in many ways.
How can the public interact with the Baldwin material? They can go there and read it?
Anyone can come and see it. Yeah, please do. And we have pop-up shows from time to time, so please visit us up on 135th and Malcolm X Boulevard.
Kevin Young, generating so much stuff on so many levels for New York right now and for the world, as director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, as the New Yorker poetry editor, and as the author of the new book, Bunk, The Rise of Hoaxes, Humbug, Plagiarists, Phonies, Post-Facts, and Fake News. Thank you so much for coming downtown.
Thanks.